Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 18th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. His open letter to journalists details his disappointment with the FCC. Today, we'll talk with former Commissioner Michael Copps about his call for action. We often talk about the beach belonging to everyone, but what about the surf competitions on the beach? City regulations could change who has access. North Shore Body Surfing Club member Alan Leonard says that could disadvantage the small promoter.
And back on the boards at Diamond Head Theater is a revival of Showboat. Leah Woods Almanza plays Magnolia, joins us with a preview. And if you're a writer in search of inspiration, we have a suggestion. Get with other writers. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Stay here for the conversation after the news. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Listening to that music, I was wondering if maybe our crew was trying to help us hearken back to the golden days of journalism.
I guess. I can't be quite sure what their motive was, but we do think about the golden days, especially in Sunshine Week. Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly where we are this week. The annual education effort to spotlight the importance of open government and freedom of information. It was launched as a national initiative by the American Society of News Editors in March of 2005. That was after several years of changes to the media landscape brought by consolidation, communication methods, and internet expansion. It wasn't a scenario that Michael Copps had envisioned when he joined the FCC in 2001, and it only intensified during his 10-year tenure. Some of that is detailed in an open letter to journalists. This week, he's in Hawaii talking about the sunshine and how much we may or may not have nationally and in Hawaii. Michael Copps joins us this morning. Thank you so much for taking time to be here.
Good morning. Thank you for taking time to have me on. I really appreciate it.
In your letter, it was primarily targeted to journalists, some of the people who have been really disadvantaged by the consolidation that we've seen, and we've seen the profession lose a lot of professional journalists over the last 10, 15 years. But in this, you say that you had joined the FCC with all these very high hopes, but the FCC that you actually came to know very quickly was one that had fallen, as you put it, madly in love with industry consolidation. It's one thing when we talk about TV, radio, print. Quite another when we talk about the internet. And your big warning for a lot of people who've based their lives in the internet is that it's going that way too.
Yes, and it's a shame. If we're going to move so much of our media and so much of our small d democratic dialogue, our civic dialogue to the internet, then we need to be very concerned about keeping that internet open and small d democratic. And instead, we're seeing now broadband and the internet go down the same trail that we saw with radio, television, and cable, toward increasing gatekeeping, toward control by a very few, toward rising consumer prices, towards their ability to block and prioritize traffic. And the tragedy is that this is such a dynamic and open and opportunity-creating technology. It should be a golden age of journalism. It absolutely should be, but it's not. And instead, what we're being presented with right now is a huge challenge and a huge problem, because if people aren't hooked up to this broadband, and everybody has it, hooked up to the internet, and unless that internet is kept open, so it's not controlled by a few, so nobody has the power to block content or tell you what news you're going to see on the internet or where you can go and where you can be directed, if we're going to let that happen, that's a tragedy of historical proportions. So
I'm sorry, do most people really understand what that would mean to have content blocked? I mean, we talk about that, and some people say it almost blithely. Well, it could mean that the content would be blocked, but really what that means for an average person could be that you don't get to see all the news, or someone is shaping your view of
right.
news, which happens in many cases anyway, but
well,
pronounced in this way.
If Comcast, which is now coming here in a big way by its proposal to take over the Time Warner, is in a position to say, well, we're going to favor this subsidiary of ours or this friend of ours, and we're going to make their traffic go faster on the Internet so people can download it, and Hawaiian Public Radio, if they have Internet, well, we'll just slow them down, you know. They don't deserve all of that priority traffic or speed. That's really a threat, I think. This is not just an economic issue. It's not just a technical issue. It's a democratic issue about how open is our civic dialogue going to be, and I think you can make the case that because of industry consolidation, with a few players buying up so much content and so much diversity, and the firing of 20, 30, 40,000 reporters, we've got so many reporters now who are walking the street looking for a job when they should be walking the beat uncovering stories that don't get told. Unless we can figure out how to do something about that, we're imperiling our democracy. We have dumbed down our civic dialogue. And I think the message is very important out here, and that's one reason why I jumped at the chance to come out here with our friends at Common Cause and Media Council to this market, which is heavily concentrated. And there have been studies showing how just a very few players control the television and the media and the newspaper. You can actually test this. This is Sunshine Week. Tomorrow night we have an event called Media Transparency in Politics at the YWCA from 5:30 to 7:30. I hope people will come out on that. I want to see if big media is really going to cover that. You're covering it. Hawaii Public Radio is doing a great job in teeing this issue up for the people of this community. But I've been to so many places in the last 10 years where there are a few gatekeepers in control of the media, and they don't cover this stuff. But you go to a town that has small independent media, they'll cover it.
Let's talk about how the FCC that you see now may or may not be meeting some of those challenges. I mean, last month earlier in the year, we heard about plans to walk into newsrooms and saying, well, you know, what's your position on this? And who really makes choices for the news? And there were other people who were journalists saying, you know, this is not okay. And some were just saying, well, that's just kind of the way it is. And there was no real consensus that maybe this was not appropriate.
We have to understand what the information needs of communities are and how they are being served. I think you can make the argument that maybe all aspects of the study that was being considered at one time weren't perfectly designed, but the commission has a responsibility to make sure that licensees are serving the public interest. That appears 112 times in the telecommunications law. So we've got to have some feel. If you come in to get your license renewed and you're getting free use of the airwaves and the ability to make a nice living off of that, but the law is very clear that you have to be serving the public interest and covering local community affairs and diversity within your communities and political campaigns and public issues. And if you're not doing that, then your license shouldn't be renewed. So I don't think there's anything untoward about the FCC trying to look into and certainly not getting involved in directing content, but just making sure that the original bargain is kept. You get free use of the airwaves. Are you serving the public interest? Are you helping this community? Or are you contributing to dumbing down the dialogue with all kinds of glitzy infotainment and no real in-depth journalism?
How do you peg the current FCC's ability to meet some of the challenges we've talked about?
I think the jury is out. We have some good commissioners there. We have a new chairman. He's saying many of the right things and surrounding himself with some good people. But these are huge questions, and they need answers. And if this commission is going to end up blessing a Comcast-Time Warner merger, or if it's not really going to take aggressive steps to protect the openness of the Internet, that so-called net neutrality issue, don't call it that. It doesn't mean anything. This is Internet freedom that we're talking about. And if they're not going to step up to the plate and do something aggressive and do it soon, then they will have failed their charge. And I will be extremely disappointed. But they have the opportunity, and I still have high hopes, but it's performance that counts.
And performance perhaps driven by public interest. How much public interest in this do you think there is?
Well, this is a public interest issue, and the challenge is for the public interest to be represented now. We know the big players are there. We know Comcast is walking the halls of the FCC right this minute while you and I are talking out here. They're walking the halls of Congress. They're spending millions of dollars to make sure that the FCC will get a lot of pressure to okay this merger. There are others who are thinking about gatekeeping and getting, you know, make sure the FCC doesn't come with new open internet rules. That's a public interest. And I don't mind, you know, when I was a commissioner, fine, Comcast, come in and talk, Time Warner, come in and talk. But I always realize this isn't the ultimate constituent. The constituency is the American people. The FCC is supposed to be a consumer protection agency, a public interest agency. So get out of Washington and go around the country and see what people really think. And I think there's a lot of unease around the country. People understand that something isn't right with their media. They're sick of the kind of infotainment that passes for news nowadays.
Well, we'll see if that lack of ease with all of that translates into action on the part of the public. I look forward to our panel tomorrow night. Thanks
so
much for being here.
Thank you.
Michael Copps is a former commissioner of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission. His years there were highlighted by his strong defense of the public interest, outreach to non-traditional stakeholders in the decisions of the FCC, and actions to stem the tide of what he regards as extensive consolidation of the nation's media and telecommunications industries. He's currently spearheading a new media democracy and reform initiative at Common Cause and will speak at several Sunshine Week events sponsored by Common Cause Hawaii, Media Council Hawaii, and the Society of Professional Journalists.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at HPR2. It's 8:15. Later in the show, Diamond Head Theater revival of a breakthrough musical. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard, a tricky quiz for you state history buffs. You know, Admission Day, or Statehood Day, is celebrated on the third Friday in August to commemorate the anniversary of the admission of Hawaii into the Union in 1959. But there were several other preliminary steps taken before the goal of statehood could be achieved. Statehood bills for Hawaii had been introduced into the U.S. Congress as early as 1919 by Prince Jonah Kalanianaole. Additional bills were introduced in 1935, 1947, and 1950. We're wondering if you know what important bill relating to statehood was approved on this day in 1959. Post your answer on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation if you know, and we'll tell you who got the answer right in the next half hour. And while you're thinking and maybe having a cup of your favorite morning brew, you know that on Tuesdays, Bill Sage goes out to check the conversation at a morning spot somewhere on Oahu. And today he's at town in Kaimuki to find out what's brewing. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning to you, Beth Ann. Yes, I'm going to town to find out what's on people's mind. This morning we have Stephanie and Miley with us. Stephanie, you're interested in the way repetitive motion injury can happen, mostly because of sports, especially growing kids. Can you fill us in on the problems of that and what's best about all-around training?
Sure. So I've noticed that as a Pilates instructor and biomechanics trainer for therapeutic applications, that there seems to be an increase in stress on the joints and ligamental tears, growth plate fractures, all the kinds of injuries that you really shouldn't be seeing in adolescents until further on in their sports careers due to, I guess it would be like monosport training. So training for one sport, doing the same motion all year round. And what the kids really need to do is some sort of either cross-training or even more importantly, training the opposite muscles that they overuse in order
action,
to get
reaction.
Balance.
Sort of an action-reaction thing.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, if you've got a kid who's playing baseball year-round, in the off-season he's doing private training in baseball and probably playing for a club, then he's using the same muscles over and over and over, not really working anything else and then putting immense strain on his body. Probably during the years where he's growing and forming his musculature the most.
So what's the best way to get the words out to the kids, what they can do to improve their physical health?
So what they need to do is pretty much have a well-rounded training program where they're not just reinforcing the same movements and patterns during the year. They've got to do some variation on their trainings.
You also brought up the fact that a lot of kids are sort of getting prematurely hunched over because they're doing too much this with a computer. So kids, in effect, lay off the computers and get some cross training. Thank you very much, Stephanie. We're kind of limited on time
Thank
for this
you.
First segment. But Miley, you were
thanks, Steph.
Joining
us. So interesting.
Mauna Ola.
I am, just because on my mind, we're going to do a 24-hour gathering to just talk story in the Hawaiian community around a man named Kenny Brown and his passing. Mm-hmm. He's an ali'i, and as a result, he's someone that we want to learn from. He was a peacekeeper, a bridge maker, and a very kind and loving human being. So as a Hawaiian, that's the kind of leadership, forgiveness and kindness and inclusiveness. So that's something I'm thinking about because I'm getting ready to stay up for 24 hours and honor him.
Almost a sort of memorial ho'oponopono?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Hawaii right now. So it's, you know, the thing that happened at KCC, mm-hmm. Go Airlines leaving, lots of ledge issues. So sitting quietly, gathering, and saying prayers and having a spiritual focus is not a bad thing, too.
When will that be?
It's from the noon on the spring equinox, which is Thursday, to noon on Friday.
Well, that's a nice one to bring about. Thank you very much for being
Mahalo,
with us.
Mahalo, Paul.
And we will be back in about half an hour to have more on What's Brewing. Meanwhile, back to the studio, Beth Ann and Chris. Mahalo.
Now imagine seeing an art form being created right in front of you. That's what it must have been like at the 1927 opening night of Showboat, the show that set a pattern for musical theater that remains in place today. About 85 years later, it's still a show with plenty to tell us, stocked with great songs and archetypal characters. Leah Woods' Almanza is Magnolia in the show, and her character goes on quite a journey. It's a Diamond Head Theater production opening 10 days from today. Leah's with us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You do go on quite a journey as this character. You start as a teenager.
Yes, correct.
Somewhat naive teenager, dare I say?
Yes, somewhat naive. I think I've been exposed to more, perhaps, than other teenagers at that age, just because I am surrounded by the Showboat people. And those are my peers growing up. I don't have the traditional schooling. I'm on the Showboat getting my education.
And the love of your life is not the sort of upright, solid citizen a girl might dream of.
No,
yeah?
Not what my mother would have chosen for me. Definitely not.
What's he like?
He comes aboard as a gambler, with some airs, questionable on the stories and the family that he tells us he's from. That's, you know, part of my leading man's job to figure out what is his depth in that character. But we do fall in love. I think it is a genuine love that happens in that first scene of our meeting.
It's one of the real truths, and you know, there's a lot of truths in this musical. It's mm-hmm. not a frothy Mm-mm. escape show. I think that's what made it different when it came out.
Yes, there are a lot of issues that are brought up that are very real and very present. And John Rampage, as our director, has really worked to get us to understand what it was like. You know, how we interact, what storyline.
One of the issues that comes Magnolia's way is that it's quite possible to fall in love with somebody that your mother might not approve of.
Right.
And you can't help it, mm-hmm. right?
Nope, can't help loving that man. Indeed.
So how do you convey something like that?
For the arc of the character?
yeah.
growth. I've been, I guess, you know, as an opera singer training and just coming into this musical and using text now and not just the notes to convey those emotions and the growth. It's been very eye-opening to me. I've had to do a lot of comparisons, but realizations that it's different for Magnolia at 16 versus Leah at 16 growing up here in Hawaii. So, ooh, how do you convey that? convey it?
Well, what's different about her at 16? What do you have to transform to be this girl at 16?
She's more simple. The exposure, you know, that she's had on the showboat is limited. The people that she's been surrounded with, her best friend Julie, for example. I mean, that's her best friend on the showboat. She doesn't have peers her age. Julie's older. Julie's the leading lady on the showboat. It's different. Magnolia looks up to her, and really, I think it's in her soul to be a performer also, which we see later on in the show. But it's
so she's kind of a naive girl in a sort of a sophisticated environment in some ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in some ways she knows, but in some ways when she meets Ravenel for example the first time, it's
Ravenel's the gambler.
Yes, it's the first time that she feels that little tingle of ooh, okay. Mm-hmm. And then he says, hey, let's make believe we fall in love. It's like, only make believe, okay. And it's a new process, a new thought that I really had not seen in my 16 years on the showboat. So
they go from making believe to the real thing, course of the song.
Yep, in the course of the song, which is what theater's about, right?
Falling and that's one of the great things, sort of the conventions of the modern musical is the falling in love song, mm-hmm. the guy and the girl, mm-hmm. who's sort of in the, you know, If I Loved You is another example.
Yeah, and I've definitely learned about that during this process of learning how to be, working on Magnolia and lyric progression, which I suppose there is lyric progression in opera, of course, but, I mean, it's very apparent in our first song, Only Make Believe. It really...
Lyric progression meaning the way the character of each verse sort of tells a different story?
Yeah, and the beats of my emotions and how they are changing and growing within a song.
So
we don't have 2 hours to let the audience see
that. It's a 3-minute song, and by the end,
the audience has to see that, oh, she's gone from this naive 16-year-old to, you know, just saying hello to this gambler. This not even a gambler, I don't know that he is that. Just saying hello because I'm friendly and I wanted to meet someone new to, wow.
To all the way in love 5 minutes later.
I love you. Yes, that's the challenge.
When you're dealing with spoken word, just the dramatic scenes that you've got, mm-hmm. it does seem daunting because when you're used to a score and a melody and, you know, chords to sort of give you an emotional framework,
yes.
you kind of have to supply all that suddenly.
It has been very challenging for me, I will admit.
Is that the toughest part?
Yes, absolutely. Thank goodness John Rampage has been very patient with me. And he's been working with me for many months, helping guide me through this. It's a toolbox that I hadn't touched upon in over 6 years, with my taking a break from my career with the children, and now really having to draw upon, the way in conveying those emotions.
But I bet he told you can do it.
Oh, yeah, he had faith in me. I hope I haven't let him down.
Yeah, I seriously doubt that you have.
Thank you.
It's great to talk to you this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Leah Woods Almanza is Magnolia in the Diamond Head Theater production of Showboat. Opens March 28th, runs until April 20th. You can find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
Fish got to swim and birds got to fly. I got to love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. Tell me he's lazy, tell me he's slow, tell me I'm crazy.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9.
there's a lot at stake, according to Michael Kopsis. We talked about a little earlier this morning. And while we're talking about taking away, let's also talk about support from station members, because that's HPR's most reliable source of funding for day-to-day operations. By giving early to Challenge 2014 and letting us take away a little of your money, you're letting us know that you believe in HPR's mission and that you want to keep us on track for an 8-day spring campaign. We'd gratefully acknowledge Lynn Flanagan of Honolulu, Steve and Ann Siegfried of Kailua, and John Hashibata of Mililani for your early gifts for Challenge 2014. You can make your early gift by March 27th, and while you're at it, find out more about HPR's Beijing May Be Closer Than You Think sweepstakes. Just call us at 955-8821 during regular business hours, or you can go online and follow the support link on hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Pagliacci and Carmina Burana March 28th, March 30th, and April 1st at the Blaisdell. More at hawaiiopera.org or 596-7858.
Why is the rate of private school attendance in Hawaii double the national average? Well, that may be a rhetorical question for many families who choose private over public school and do whatever it takes to make it happen. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You talked to a family that's going to incredible lengths to keep kids out of public school and keeping at least a couple of them into public school and private school, given the cost factor. They're obviously not asking the question, is it worth it?
That's right. And this is Aaliyah Wong, our education reporter, story, and she's done a terrific job of talking to a lot of folks of why they send their kids to private schools rather than public. And you mentioned that it's twice the national average. It absolutely is. 16% of Hawaii-age, school-aged children go to private schools. The national average is 8%. Why do they do that? Why do parents dig deep to pay for private school? Many reasons. Social status, peer pressure, campus safety, class sizes are smaller, and there's a general perception that the educational level is going to be higher at private schools.
Interesting that you put that one last, not for any particular other reason, but just that there is this idea that somehow you can't fool around with your kid's life because they're only a kid for a very short period of time. And that means a lot of parents feel that private education is the way to go. But what does that really say about any impact for the public schools?
Well, one of the things that Aaliyah talks about in her story is this persistent narrative that our public schools in Hawaii are somehow inadequate. And she actually talks to an expert who says that's really a myth. The schools are much better than we give them credit for. But they are aging facilities. Even Catherine Matayoshi, the superintendent of the schools, sends her kids to Iolani, in part because it's a family tradition. That's another reason people send their kids to private school. Their parents did, therefore their kids are going to go there as well.
So when we look at the cost of sending a child to private school in Hawaii, that can be as much as maybe $20,000 at Punahou, of many that are less. But when you look at what they are on the East Coast, you could be spending $35,000 or $40,000 to send your child
there. It's actually less to send kids to private school here, about $9,000 a year on average. So in many ways, still a bargain. But if you're dealing with the cost of living in Hawaii, you can imagine that's only exacerbated.
Right, and struggle is struggle. And there's plenty of that to go around when it comes to raising kids and figuring out what to do to best give them an education. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Perhaps it's an old contest for attention. surfing versus bodyboarding. In the last week, it took the spotlight by way of proposed changes to the rules for awarding contest permits to use the beach on Oahu's North Shore. The changes are up for public comment until tomorrow. The director of the Pipeline Body Surfing Classic says those changes would disadvantage smaller operators and shut down event diversity. Alan Lennard is on the phone with us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It would be easy to sort of characterize this as a David Goliath situation, but there are a lot more subtleties going on here. What would you say is the most effective way of explaining some of those subtleties as to who gets to use the beach?
Well, you know, the way that things have been evolving, this is a multi-year process for people who've been running contests. The city started as an example. They started the contest I've been running. They started it. The city created the contest. Over time, the city moved away from allowing that contest to be operated with them. They wanted it to be privatized. Now they're kind of going to, it appears to be they're like trying to force all the types of contests to fit into one kind of box. The rules are, most of the difficult rules have to do with the way that they choose who gets a contest and who doesn't. And that process actually came from a court lawsuit, and it was a judge told them they had to come up with some rules, and they came up with them really quickly and never tested them until they started using them. And then they only discovered the problems when people started saying, why are all your contests surfing contests, or what happened to the bodyboarding event? So, but the city didn't want to admit that it was their process. They just keep kept adding new, more complexities to it instead of reanalyzing why their process wasn't working.
In that reanalyzing of the process that you'd like to see happen, what do you think needs to be the starting point?
Well, a while back, probably about 15 years ago, the city had been using the same process that, like they use for soccer fields, which is they basically use we're using a form of mediation, and I had persuaded them to at least include in their most recent draft the language for a little tiny bit of mediation. It's not enough. It's not real. The tools aren't there. We need the city to grasp the fact that mediation works. Right now, the way they do it is they have four people who I think they pay $30 or $35 or $40 an hour to, spending probably pretty much a week to vote on who gets a permit. And I think even if a mediator costs more money, the mediator could do the whole thing in a day, and it would be less money. And I think that they should reanalyze that process to include, to make mediation accepted in their instead of just kind of like saying, well, if you want to do mediation, you got to do it on your own, and we'll give you like a couple weeks, and you know, and if you don't do it, then we're gonna, you know, the only thing good about their bad process, it's like a dagger that scares everybody into going to a mediation. If a mediation really was true, everybody would probably go to it because it's probably an option that would give them a better chance of getting a contest.
But you sort of jumped from the how do we start a process that's going to be fair for everybody in choosing who gets those permits to what do you do when there's a problem, and there's the issue of mediation. So going back to the beginning for a second, with only 64 permits, we're talking about a finite space. How would you see this done in the fairest way possible?
Well, first of all, there's not 64 contests. There's just 64 days. Most contests use anywhere from 1 to 4 days each.
I'm sorry, I meant permits.
Permits. Yeah,
I meant 64 permits.
I want a permit. So there's an absolute maximum of 64 days they can give. You divide it up between Sunset Beach. It's a complex thing. You got to understand the scheduling. But basically, a lot of the rules that they're proposing, I have no problem with. I mean, if you know, as far as following all the other rules, yeah. But what it really comes down to, like, I think that, you know, on the TV piece, they had one person was upset about something to do with it, the more money you donate to a nonprofit, the better your ranking. Well, I don't really have any problem with that. I mean, I think it's kind of arbitrary. But they're trying to come up with something they can push through so they can close the books on it. It's
yes,
not
Mr.
necessarily
Lenard, I have a question for you, though. If you have problems with the way the rules are and you want to see this done in a fair way possible, what would you like to see happen that would make it fair for all, larger promoters, smaller promoters, so that whatever these 64 days or however they're divided up, in your eyes, would be done in a fair way?
Well, the process that's flawed is the conflict resolution process itself, because there's always going to be someone applying, more than one person applying for the same time. So the process in which they choose who gets it is the problem. Okay, that is the problem. They don't understand. It doesn't really give a balance or a diversity. They actually removed some of the wording for diversity out of the rules to try to make it look like it doesn't shouldn't have anything to do with diversity. But the reality is, it really does have to do with to make sure that the whole calendar is nothing but surfing or bodyboarding or body surfing. It should mix, be a good mix. So the way they have to do that should. Right now, they're doing it by having a group of people give a numerical ranking to each event based on these unusual characteristics. They need to go back to the basics and realize that the tools they need would be the same tools that a mediator would need. They have to create the tools, the right questions. The each contest promoter needs to come up with their priority list, say, I can run it in a certain period of time because I'm looking for this kind of surf. I only need really a couple days. I don't need 3 days. So get them to basically get really honest on what they need instead of like the person saying, oh, I'm raising $10 million. They're trying to make all the contests be the bigger, more gigantic events. But that's not. But the Menuhuni is an example. It's a little kids event. Mm. How are they going to compete with a $500,000 surf contest?
So just because we need to go in just a second, your bottom line point seems to be the focus on the diversity of the events and who they really serve and what that says about all the city and the contest that it wants to help promote by giving a permit. And that's the process that you'd like to see retooled.
That's a big part of it. I mean, right now, they could probably save money by using a real mediation model with their unusual conflict resolution used as the ongoing threat.
Mr. Lenard, we have to go. I'm sorry. We are slaves to the clock, and I'm sorry we have to go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Al Lenard is the contest director for the Pipeline Body Surfing Classic. It began in 19... I can't see what this date is, but anyway, since 2008, Mr. Lenard says the contest has been denied a permit 5 out of 6 times by the Department of Parks and Recreation. If you'd like to weigh in on the proposed rules, you have until tomorrow to submit your comments to the city.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about an important bill relating to statehood that was approved by the U.S. Congress on this day in 1959. The Hawaii Admission Act was signed into law by then-President Dwight D. Eisenhower, dissolving the territory of Hawaii and establishing Hawaii as the 50th state and the most recent state to be admitted to the Union. On that same day, the Territorial Senate voted to adopt Aloha State as Hawaii's official nickname. Ironically, the statehood bill had run into a great deal of opposition from Southern senators, including then-Texas Senator Lyndon Johnson. But on this day, Hawaii became a state, and the territorial legislature, with its very last act, established the state of Hawaii. That's our backyard quiz for today. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And now from a bit of history to current events and back to town in Kaimuki with Bill Sage to find out what's brewing.
I think I can keep it well documented. Today we have documentarian Lori with us, and she is working on the Palila bird, which is endangered, about 1,700 of them up in Mauna Kea. Good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Bert.
So the little bird, tell us what the little bird told you about its own life.
Well, it is one of the last remaining finch-billed Hawaiian honeycreepers that are still extant in the main Hawaiian Islands. And it is critically endangered, so it's you might have seen it on TV. There's been some PSAs that have been running.
You've been documenting it in film yourself?
Yeah, I actually did a short documentary about the Palila in 2010, and mm-hmm. I'm researching doing a longer version of that story because there's a lot more that I didn't get to cover.
So you're up there getting all the footage yourself?
Not right now, but I am researching it right now.
Okay, so the hope is to make a full-length feature documentary upon it.
Yes, yes.
Not just the Palila, but other endangered birds as well?
Well, the story of the Palila is the story of all Hawaiian birds. They have been, in trouble for a long time for lots of reasons, but, every 10 years or so, there's another bird that's going extinct because of the kinds of problems with the environment. And so, right now, Palila is the one that they're trying to save.
Okay, well, I wish you the best in your endeavors. I still remember the O'o'a'a bird. They sighted one back in the 70s, and so far, no. All right, well, thank you very much, Lori. And also sitting with us is another woman who does a lot of documentarian work, and she's quite interested in films by women. Shirley, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So today you wish to speak about women in film.
Yes, I do.
And
I think that in films by women,
because
I'm here to support filmmakers like Lori and other women here in Hawaii who are making local documentary films and all kinds of films, and really kind of shining a light on the fact that most of the media that you see on television and all the forms of television are made by men, are written by men, directed by men. But women have a lot to say. Obviously, they're half the population, and they have a lot of opportunities to make films on the local level. And so people should kind of have their antennas up that there's a lot of really great local films by women being made here in Hawaii.
Well, thanks for helping bringing the antennas up, and I'm sure you and Lori will continue to make those things happen, and we'll continue to make this a venue for everybody who wishes to opine right here on What's Brewing. And next week, we'll be over at Kimo Bean in Waikiki. And now, with a sip behind us, let's go back to the studio.
It's tough to find the ideal environment to be a writer. Some of the time you might want to work in isolation. At other times you might crave a little peer interaction, a little feedback. It's rare for writers to be in a place where everything that feeds their art is close at hand. But Constance Hale has addressed the issue with the writer's retreat she's putting together for Camp Mokuleia in early May. She's brought a variety of people together to create a convergence of creative energy, and she's inviting writers of all persuasions to take part. She joins us by phone. Good morning, Connie.
Hey, Chris.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
You know, on one level, writing is a solitary occupation. Kind of has to be, right?
Exactly.
But not always. And when are the not always times?
Well, you know, it varies from writer to writer. A lot of writers are true introverts, and they don't thrive on interaction with other people, but many writers are extroverts, so we need to spend that time alone with the page and with our thoughts and riding the currents of our imagination. But we also need someone to read our stuff to. We need an audience. We want an audience, and sometimes we need support. You know, sometimes you write something and you're not sure if you're going in the right direction. It's really helpful to have folks around whom you can trust and whose opinions you trust. So it's really a mixed bag, and it's hard to live the writing life and get the balance right sometimes.
Yeah, you think of writers who somehow managed to thrive under all kinds of adverse conditions. You wonder how they did it. I'm thinking of Charles Dickens with his kids crawling all over him all day long, right? Churning out book after book. So had amazing powers of concentration.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that balance between the alone time. Sometimes when you're just alone with your work, you can get a little bit lost in the tall weeds, yeah?
You can. And, you know, One thing that's so wonderful about this writer's retreat is the beach is right there. I grew up on Mokulele'a Beach, so for me there's nothing better for my imagination than just to walk down the beach, listen to the ocean. And there's something I often find that some of my best ideas, or sometimes when I get tangled into a knot, a little bit of movement, whether it be swimming or walking on the beach or taking a hike, releases that and undoes that knot for me. So it's one reason why I think this is such an ideal place to gather writers together. There are those times when you can be completely alone, or you can be alone with the Mother Ocean nearby, or you can hang out with some other writers.
Well, I like that your use of that phrase, undoes the knot, because that is what happens when you're sort of alone with your text for too long.
I find with every time I write a book, I'll write, I usually write 5 or 6 hours a day. I can't usually write. It's such an intense activity. I can't do more than that. But almost always, the metaphors come to me when I'm swimming in the swimming pool right afterwards. You can't sit at your desk and force a metaphor.
Yeah.
But sometimes if you just take a walk, go for a swim, everything starts moving and the imagination starts moving as well.
I sometimes feel, Connie, as if it isn't that you're generating the ideas, it's that you're finding things that are somehow out there. Do you ever get that feeling?
Absolutely. Well, there's kind of two things. One is I think you open your pores a little bit the idea of this retreat in particular is to open your pores to nature and to let things come in.
Mm-hmm.
The imagination works in mysterious ways, and there are times when what you need to do more than anything else is prepare the ground and wait or be receptive to or empty your mind, maybe is a better way of putting it. Just empty your mind of all kinds of trivial thoughts so that you're open to the magic of the imagination.
The trouble with emptying your mind is that I think some people might get a little panicky that it was never going to get filled again.
Well, we try. That's one of the other things about the retreat is we have workshop leaders and ways to kind of stimulate ideas and encourage the imagination.
Because an awful lot of it is really about the writer's confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think? That's really an intangible. I'm not sure how you generate that, because...
Oh, it's such an interesting question, because I find that a lot of my favorite writers, particularly when I teach, are the people that have the most self-doubt.
Yeah.
So there's a very interesting relationship between self-doubt and confidence in writing. On the one hand, you need to have enough confidence in yourself and enough experience, in a way, to know when something is good, to recognize when something works. On the other hand, those people who are too facile or too confident, sometimes the writing lacks richness, so there's almost a kind of self-doubt that's necessary in order to mull over things in an interesting way or develop interesting thoughts or storylines or plots. At the same time, without confidence, the book doesn't get written.
I always feel that I want to feel a little bit of the struggle, or I want to feel that the writer has struggled a little bit for me. One of my favorite writers is the humorist S.J. Perelman, who said, easy writing makes for difficult reading.
That's true. I think I agree, and I agree with you. You can tell when a writer has maybe mulled over things I also think you just need to work the text to a certain amount. I mean, any good writer works a lot on crafting sentences and choosing words. You just don't write it out and let it publish. You work it, and of course that's what we focus on this writing retreat, is that actually what is the writer's craft and how do you work the craft?
I find when I start working a text that I've written, it gets a lot shorter. There's
that
old line, if I'd had more time, I could have written less,
Well, there's a famous quote about this. A lot of people attribute the quote to Mark Twain, and I actually did some research, and it's Blaise Pascal, who said in a letter to a friend, "I had hoped to write you a short letter, but lacking time, I wrote a long one."
That's perfect. Connie, great to talk to you. Good luck with this workshop.
Likewise, Chris. Thanks so much for your support.
My pleasure. Constance Hale is a writer who's the author of Sin and Syntax and Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, among other works. She's the guiding spirit behind Mokulia Writers Retreat, runs from May 4th to 9th, and is enrolling writers now. Details are at hpr2.org.
On the next Fresh Air, a story of cannibalism and colonialism. Journalist Carl Hoffman investigates the disappearance of 23-year-old Michael Rockefeller from off the coast of New Guinea over 50 years ago while on an expedition to collect primitive art. Hoffman's new book is called Savage Harvest. Also, an interview with saxophonist and composer Marty Ehrlich. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Well, it's going to wrap it up for us on this second day of Sunshine Week. Good to talk to Michael Copps this morning.
He's really been kind of a conscience for the contemporary journalist, in a sense, huh?
Well, there are a lot of people who saw him as that, and he hasn't stopped doing it since he left the FCC. He's been crisscrossing the country, talking to a lot of journalists, a lot of media outlets, trying to really take the pulse of what's happening in America and let a lot of us realize that there's a great deal at stake, particularly as we look at, as he called, internet freedom.
We've gotten so much from the journalistic tradition in this country. It really is the glory of the country, and we really like to see it continue.
Well, he says those glory days could be ahead of us if we pay a lot of attention to what's going on right now.
Good.
That's going to do it for us for this morning. We'll be back tomorrow. We're going to look at the proposed higher taxes for tobacco products, and Neil Milner will be here for the next installment of The Long View.
And we'll trace a remarkable life journey with the redheaded Hawaiian.
You can suggest a conversation you'd like to hear. In the meantime, you can just post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation or tell me at BecauseHPR.
Past shows, links to more information, lots of other good things are archived on our website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you tomorrow morning with Chris right here with you for more of The Conversation.